Alaska Public Media's Every Little Bit recognizes people who go above and beyond to strengthen our community in Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
I think if someone wants to start a community event, they should just go for it.
I believe in serving your neighbor, love one another.
There's always something that you can do.
Wherever people meet one another's needs, all of us are enriched by that.
Do you know someone doing good in your community? Nominate them at alaskapublic.org/littlebit.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordot. March is prime time for winter sports in Alaska. The light is back, the snow is cleared, and Alaskans are ready to enjoy it all. Dog mushing has been part of Alaska as long as people have lived here. On this show, we visit Robert and Nicole Forto of Team Inuka to learn a little about the mushing life. The second half of the show, Alice Knapp shares the newly published columns of Miss Ufda, who is an advice columnist in the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage's newsletter in the 90s and O's. Stay tuned for a little mushing and a little trail etiquette.
All right, on this show we're talking about dog mushing. I'm here with Robert Forto at Inuka Kennels, is that right?
Inuka.
Inuka Kennels, and welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Yes, my name's Robert Forto. Been a dog musher since 1994, moved up to Alaska in 2010, chasing that crazy Iditarod dream, and everything got in the way, of course. I went back to school. I had a daughter that wanted to do junior Iditarod, and boy, I tell you what, as long as I can do it and I'm not 80 or 90, I'm all good.
So tell us about your story, that story a little bit, like how you got into this. And with the sort of the hat on of like, for listeners who might be interested in dog mushing and they have a dream, or they have a kid that has a dream of dog mushing, like, walk us through that, how that worked for you.
In 1994, I was living in Portland, Oregon, going to school at Portland State. I was going to be a veterinarian, but I thought, I don't want to be in a vet office with a lab coat on all the time. So I became a dog trainer, started dog training in the parks of Portland. Pretty much I showed up with a leash, a smile, and a business card and started my business. That business still operates today. And shortly thereafter, my grandfather passed away and he left me a cabin in Minnesota. And with that, I immediately packed up my bags, moved to Minnesota, and clearly I had to do something up there adventurous. And I didn't know anything about sled dogs at that point other than what I knew from the movies with Iron Will and Balto and that sort of thing. So I got into the Siberian world. I was doing competition obedience and that sort of thing. And then I saw an ad.
And that's a Siberian dog.
Siberian dogs,
right.
Yes.
You didn't go to Siberia. It's okay.
Yep. Yeah. So then I saw an ad in a dog magazine. You're a real nerd if you read dog magazines. So I saw an ad for a kennel that was in the mountains of Georgia. And here I am, 23 years old or so. I pack up a 280Z, Datsun 280Z sports car, and I drive from, at the time I was still in Portland, I drive from Portland, Oregon to the mountains in Georgia, kind of near Atlanta. And the lady had some Siberian Huskies, and she came out and said, "Hey, do you want to go for a ride?" Much like we did with you today, Paul. And she hooked us up to a cart, and we took off, and I was hooked. As they say, it gets in your blood, and you're stuck. I ended up leaving with two Siberians, Rutger and Reich were their names, and that was the foundation of my first kennel in Minnesota. And we ran there for years until 1999, 6-7 years. And then I eventually caught up with my soon-to-be wife, Michelle. We actually met online in a Yahoo chat room. She was online and she was asking questions about how do I teach my kids, Nicole, who's going to be in the interview a little later, how do I teach my kids how to have their dog pull? They had a Malamute. And of course, being in a chat room in 1999, I chimed in and I said, "I can help you with that." So I helped her out. We started talking on the phone. Before long, I flew out to Colorado and we got married about a year later. We were there for, it was love at first sight, as they say. We were there for about 10 years or so. And then the whole Iditarod thing caught my eye, and we moved up here and never looked back.
When you were in Minnesota and Colorado, were you racing at all?
I was doing a lot of mid-distance racing at the point, mid-distance sprint. I had Siberian, so I was never very fast. Yeah. So I loved it. I loved doing those 40, 50-mile runs. I loved doing a circuit, which is much different than what we have up here. The sprint mushers still have a circuit, but any distance mushers do not have a circuit up here at all. Down in the lower 48, you can literally start on one end of the country and finish on the other end, very similar to NASCAR.
And so you're a circuit, meaning you're building points, or
it's
a bunch of different races adding up to something.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And I was going to say, with those Siberians, how many were you racing? Talk about mid-distance racing a little bit for people who don't know. Like the different kind of racing, what they are, like sprint, mid-distance, and then the longer races.
Sprint mushing, you're kind of easy way to describe it. Sprint mushing is typically the number of dogs is the number of miles. So if you have four dogs, you're running 4 miles, six dogs, 6 miles, eight dogs, 8 miles, etc. So you're limited on the number of miles and, of course, the number of dogs. But the nice thing about sprint mushing is you run 8 miles, you pack up your dogs, and you either stay in a hotel or you go back home and sleep, which is beautiful. And then mid-distance mushing, at least in the lower 48, is typically anything over 12 to, say, 30, 40 miles. So it's a longer run, but it's typically two heats. So you'll run that 30-mile heat on Saturday, and then you'll turn around and do it again on Sunday.
Gotcha. And then up here, is that the same? The mid-distance, is that sort of the same idea?
The mid-distance up here is way different. Typically, a mid-distance up here are your Iditarod qualifiers. Those are your 100s, or excuse me, your 150s, your 200s, your 350s, your 300s. Those types of races are what they call mid-distance up here. And most always, you're training for Iditarod.
Right, and that's and the qualifier for the Iditarod, is that 300 that you have to do, or how's that work?
I believe right now it's 750.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
A total difference, or the whole, or one race?
You have to have 2 300s and at least a 150 or a
200. Gotcha, yeah, so multiple races. Great. And then the longer the Iditarod and the Quest.
Those sorts of races, of course, are around 1,000 miles.
Yeah. And so you're in Colorado, and so what? Talk about the Iditarod bug. That was your dream.
Well, I befriended an Iditarod veteran, Hugh Neff, in 2009 or so. And he said, hey, why don't you come up to Alaska and help me out on Iditarod prep? That sort of thing. So I flew up and we did the ceremonial start. And at the time, he was friends with a realtor. His name is David Shear. And they're good buddies. And we stayed at his house. And in passing, after that Iditarod started, Hugh was out on the trail. In passing, hand me the card like a typical realtor. He said, hey, by the way, Robert, if you're ever interested in buying something in Alaska, give me a call. And there he handed me his business card. And that was in March. And by June, we had decided to move, and we bought this place in July.
Yeah, in the small world for the radio listeners, you bought it from
Lori Townsend, who happens to be a host here on your channel.
Yeah, it's a very small world. I didn't know that until I got out there, so that's pretty exciting. And so, and what do you have? What's sort of describe your operation here? What your business or businesses?
Well, we have 36 sled dogs. Almost all of them now are Alaskan Huskies. We have two Siberians. One of them we just picked up last week from Maine. Most of them have pretty distinguished racing lines. So we do a little bit of tours, not too often, but we've been teaching for the last few years before COVID, and we do expeditions, mid-distance races, that sort of stuff.
Talk about the expeditions. What's that about?
Well, interesting story is when I was at school at UAA, my graduate project, if you will, was to design a course, which we called the Winter Multisport Expedition. And we brought all the students out from the outdoor leadership program, and we took them on a trip over spring break. I think it was about 160 miles or so. We took them out on dog teams, fat bikes, snow machines, and we did that loop from Willow to Yetna to Northwoods to Eagle Song and back. So a nice loop. It was awesome.
That's great. I skied that a long time ago. And so that is great. And those students, did they have any experience, or were you
relatively no experience? They came out very similar to you and got their mushing legs, if you will, a few weeks beforehand. And they all did awesome. The format of the expedition was every day they did something else. So if they started today on the dog team, tomorrow they would do fat bike. The next day they would do snow machine support. And each day they would switch off. So you may get stuck doing a 30-mile fat bike ride one day or a 10-mile dog mushing ride or whatever. But it was truly like a triathlon of winter sports. Nothing like it anywhere in the country, and I can't wait to teach it again.
Yeah, let's do that. That sounds great.
Yes.
So this is Paul Torlach with Alaska Public Media's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm talking here with Robert Forto about dog mushing. So let's talk about learning how to dog mush. You teach dog mushing. What are some of the things that, if someone's interested in this, what are some suggestions you have how to go about learning, and maybe some basic things that people should know before they go investing a lot into it?
Well, definitely, if you're just wanting to get your feet wet, obviously take a tour. A lot of the tours will allow you to drive a sled for a little while, but most tours are typically a tour. You get on, you take a ride, you get off, but a lot of people get hooked that way. There are many Iditarod veterans right now who got hooked by doing a tour. Otherwise, a high suggestion is to handle or become a mentor or become a mentee of somebody is a good way to do it. Or, as you and I have a relationship, go to the university, take a course. I know UAA offers it, APU offers it. Unfortunately, they were canceled this year for low enrollment, but that's a great way to learn how to do the sport, because you're going to get hands-on, you're going to get theory behind it, you're going to learn the equipment, all of that, which is much more in-depth than just going out to a kennel and going for a ride.
What are some of the things we'll hear in the audio later? Hopefully, it's a noisy sport.
Yep.
It's a very noisy sport, and it's a very quiet sport. But what are some of the things that we'll start with? Some of the challenges of the sport, and then we'll get into some of the rewards. So, what are some of the challenges of being in this business and this sport?
The biggest challenge right now is climate. Climate change is huge in this sport. As you and I know in our conversations, early this winter, it was a sheet of ice. We could not run dogs at all. And here it is mid-February. I'm not sure when this airs, probably around Iditarod. But recently is when we got our snow. Beforehand, we would get snow in October, November. Almost always, we count our season by running on Thanksgiving. We do a Thanksgiving run. And we're almost always on sleds at that point. We haven't been on sleds on Thanksgiving in 3 or 4 years. So climate change is real happening. It's happening for real.
Yeah. And so, climate change, that's sort of the big picture. What about some of the smaller picture things? You know, like people have this romantic idea of dogs and dog mushing, but then what's the nitty gritty?
The nitty gritty is by far economics. It is very expensive to have a kennel of dogs. We have a mid-sized kennel of 36 dogs, and our food bill is over $2,000 a month. We don't skimp on that. Our dogs come before the mortgage, and you've seen our house. We aren't living in a mansion or anything like that. I always tell people, if I didn't have dogs, I would probably have a plane and a yacht both.
Those cost a lot of money too, by the way.
Yes, they do. But it's probably about the same expense as a dog team. So that's a real reality is the expense and the time. You know, this is our life. It's not a job. It's not a chore. It's our life. Everything that we do revolves around taking care of the dogs. We get up early to do it. We go to bed late after it's done, and we think about it all the time.
Yeah. Well, that obviously have a very well-run operation here. I've been very impressed with it. And so let's go on to the rewards. Like what are some things that you keep you going?
By far, just being out there on the trail with the dogs, you can totally get out there and be in the element. And you'll find that in most sports, whether you do backcountry skiing or long distance biking or whatever, motorcycle riding, whatever it is, just getting out there and enjoying the time with your dogs is by far the biggest reward. And of course, the accolades of watching dogs grow up from puppies to be magnificent sled dogs. And of course, there's a big letdown with that, because here, all the dogs stay here until they die. So we see them as pups. They stay with us for 10, 12, 14 years, and then they have to move on. And that's a huge reality, but it's a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Yeah, they don't live nearly long enough.
Right. That. Yep, for sure.
I was going to say, when you talked about the aging of the dogs, the lifespan of the dogs, so you have puppies?
Occasionally, yes. We've only had 3 or 4 litters of pups since we've been here. We keep our breeding to a minimum. We only breed when we need to. As you said, dogs age out. A typical working life of a sled dog, if they're competitive, is about 6 to 8 years or so. So they have 2 or 3 years of puppy life, and then they have several years of life afterwards. But you have to have that prime. Otherwise, it's kind of like athletes. You have to keep the machine rolling.
One of the things, with the dogs, that then, as far as training goes, how much time are they getting in? Like, you know, every day, let's say, describe a normal day for you, like in the wintertime.
A normal day is typically starting around 7 o'clock in the morning. We get up, do our chores. That takes about an hour and a half. If we're not working or teaching or going to school or whatever, the dogs are here alone typically for no longer than 4 hours. And then we'll come back in the afternoon. We'll typically run in the afternoon. And depending on what our schedule is for the season, whether we're doing sprint mushing or mid-distance racing or expeditions or whatever, we'll determine how far we go. If we're doing sprint mushing, we're just doing 10 or 12 miles. If we're doing expeditions, we may do 40 or 50 miles, which is a 6, 8, 10-hour run, depending on what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And then we'll come back. We'll do all the chores at the end of the day and then get up and do it all over again tomorrow.
Wow. And are all the dogs, you know, run a day, rest a day, run a day? Is there some sort of a schedule for them?
Typically, we do 3 days on, 2 days off. And almost all of our dogs are on that same schedule. We do have several dogs that can't run like that anymore. Of course, the older dogs or the puppies. Yeah. But it's almost always 3 days on, 2 days off. And that just goes 7 days a week, all mushing season long.
And you probably really get to know the dogs and their personalities. Yep. and then it sort of becomes a team. Well, it's a team, right? So you're figuring out where to put the dogs and who's a leader and who's not, and yep, that and how's that work?
Well, we try to train all of our dogs to be leaders, because you never know when that position's going to need to become available. Whether they get hurt on the trail, or we have to drop them, or they just don't want to lead that day or whatever. We try to train all of our dogs to be lead dogs. And that's a little bit different than a lot of other kennels. Most of them have their go-to leaders. And they have, if you think of Lance Mackey and Zorro and Larry and those sort of dogs that he had, those were his go-to leaders that, you know, ran every Iditarod. Whereas us, we have a pack of leaders, which is a very nice thing to have.
Yeah, and that seems to be my impression of the trend in mushing a little bit too. You have every dog can swap roles around.
Yep, and it's important if you have, like we said earlier, we teach this as a college class. You have to have multiple small teams. Yeah. So if you have a core of 30 dogs that are running, and you're running 6-dog teams, you can't run the same dogs all the time. And if you have 9 or 10 students here, that's several teams every day. You know, it's different than if you're just doing training where you hook up 12 or 14 or 16 dogs and then take them out on a 50-mile run. You're going to have the same dogs running every day, whereas us, we sort of rotate them in all the time.
Yeah. One of the things I think when I think about, you mentioned earlier, athletes and being out biking and skiing. But one thing I love about dog mushing is a lot of work seems to come before and after. When you're sitting on the sled, it can be work, but it's really joyful. I mean, it's very, almost blissful.
It is blissful. You get in that zone. And I know most mushers will tell you one of the biggest rewards is being out there in the middle of the night, seeing the northern lights. You're with your dogs. It's 20 below. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah, it takes a lot of work to get there, but the rewards are plentiful.
Tell us about some of your, you have some stories, some excited moments, some of those blissful moments.
I have a lot of stories. Let me tell you a little bit about our dogs. We name all of our dogs in crews, we call them. One of our crews, you ran a lot of those guys today. We have the Rock and Roller crew. Uh-huh. So we have Grohl and Sully, Jazz and Jagger, and Cobain. All of those dogs are a rock and roll theme. Uh-huh. We have another crew that is the Nightmare Before Christmas crew. We call it the Nightmare Crew. We have Lock, Shock, Barrel, and Burton of that crew. And we have, let's see, what's another crew? We have two new pups down here, and they are the Reggae Crew, and they are Ziggy and Marley.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes,
that's great. And are those sort of similar ages? It's crew.
All the crews are the litters. Oh, so those are our litters.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So that Nightmare
gotcha, right, yeah.
crew are all siblings, and then the Rock and Roller crew are all siblings.
I gotcha. Yes. Yeah. All right. So yeah. So when you're out and going back to that sort of those moments or those stories. Like, I guess you talked about when you first started, you had that moment you were hooked. Yep. And that was it?
That was it. You know, it's like a drug. It's intense. It's hard to describe. Yeah. Real quick story. My first year here, I ran the Tustamina 200 down on the peninsula, Kenai Peninsula. And my friend Dave, who happened to sell me this house here, he said, oh, it'll be an easy race. It's just hills. That's, oh, okay, no problem. Hills to me, Minnesota hills are, you know, 100 feet tall.
Yeah.
So I hooked up a team there, and we headed down to the Kenai, and those hills are mountains down there. I don't know what range that is. You probably know better than I do, but we definitely bit off more than we could chew. I had 12 dogs at that race, my first Iditarod run qualifier ever, and I could not get up and down those hills by myself. And the dogs pretty much gave me the finger. After about 50 miles, they said, you know what, dude, we're not doing this either. So I hooked up a dog that I got from Hugh Neff. Her name was Sydney, who just happened to pass away last week. So she was one of the first foundational kennels here of Team Aneke. And I put her in single lead, and I got out in front of her, and I said, okay, Sydney. Sydney had ran Iditarod and, you know, quests and all that. Big-time lead dog for Hugh. And I said, okay, Sydney, we got to get up over these hills. And I hooked her up in single lead, and I walked out in front of her for a while. And before long, Sydney took the team on her back, as they say, and we got to that that first checkpoint. And what a relief, I tell you what.
But you kept going.
We kept going. And as they say, the rest is history. And I've tried a lot of races up to this point. Still have not... found either the time, the money, or the gumption to tackle Iditarod yet. But I think the oldest person that ever started Iditarod was 74. So I still have 22 years or so before I'm the oldest person to ever start Iditarod. So I got plenty of time.
Yeah. Well, not everybody has to do it. If you're enjoying yourself and everything. Let's talk about risk management a little bit. What are some of the things you think about when you're talking about taking students out or yourself or, you know, people like me?
Biggest thing here on our trails, and you saw a little bit when you ran, was overflow. Overflow is a big deal, especially this time of the year as it warms up. A lot of our lakes will freeze thaw, and I don't know how many times we've taken students out where we've seen unseen overflow and gotten stuck in waist-deep water. And that could be a big-time deal if they don't know what to do. Yeah. That's a big risk. Being out there and making sure you have a way to get back, whether it be a sat phone or a tracker or something like that, is a big deal. And making sure that you're prepared for whatever's going to come. You're not out there on a snow machine. You know, you just can't push start and you know, end up at the destination. You have 6, 8, 10, 12 dogs that are relying on you to take care of, and of course they're going to take care of you on the trail, but it has to be a very synchronized, systematic approach to get from one checkpoint to another or one roadhouse to another on expeditions or whatever, because it doesn't stop. You know, you can't go to a roadhouse or a lodge and, you know, park your dog team and go in and have a beer. You've got work to do on both sides, morning and night.
What? No beer?
After.
After, okay.
Take care of. Yes. A musher never sleeps, as they say. Yes.
Yeah. And how about moose? Everybody talks about moose and dogs. Is that an issue?
We've had a lot of moose encounters here. One time we were out on these same trails here, and it was a big snow year. The berms were at least chest high, so we were really kind of in a tunnel. And I remember, like yesterday, that all the dogs' ears perked up. before I saw it, and a moose jumped right over the dog team. And,
wow.
Oh, yeah. So they whoop and didn't stop. And I thought, oh, you know, I almost lost it. I almost pooped the pants, as they say. But that was a big-time encounter.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah. That's really exciting.
Moose are dangerous. Dog teams have been trampled by them. Many years ago, you know, people would carry guns on Iditarod Trail. I don't know if they do that anymore. I know just recently they had a moose encounter on the Willow 300, and it stopped the lead teams there for several hours. The moose would not give way. So the three teams there, the leaders of that big race, all were kind of
stuck
there till they moved on.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I've definitely been skidzooing and running the moose, and it's really exciting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're not the moose as they are in the 48. We got some. Of course, we're an Alaska radio show, so you know.
Yeah. Thanks. So, you mentioned your dog training experience, and I know your daughter also trains dogs. So, is that that obviously comes in handy?
Yep, that pays the bills. That is our daily job. We operate Alaska Dog Works, the three of us, my daughter, my wife, and I, and we train dogs all over the state. We've trained them from Nome to Kotzebue to Juneau and on. We harness the state for dog training.
And you're just doing the train. It's just like dog side. What kind of training are you doing?
Typically, it's basic obedience, pet dogs, but we do service dogs. We have a contract with the Elks Lodge where we train dogs for veterans. We also do therapy dogs. We have a program that we train with pastors in a church, so they can take them to therapy-type sessions, that type of work. And, of course, we do some sports as well, whether it be winter sports like ski joring or bike joring or anything like that. Of course, if it's a dog, we'll train it to do something.
And does that your experience that come in handy with the mushroom?
Of course. I think I have the perfect job as a dog trainer because I have literally lived with a pack of dogs my entire career. I didn't learn to become a dog trainer through a bunch of books or videos, how a lot of dog trainers are learning today through watching YouTube and TikTok and all that. I've literally had a science experiment in my backyard to learn from since I was in college.
Well, I've been super impressed with your kennel and how well behaved they are and friendly they are, and it's really impressive. All right, so here we are in your shop, and so we're looking at your – what do you got in here?
So we have all of our freezers full of meat. We feed about 40 pounds of meat a day and about 20 pounds of kibble with our 36 sled dogs. Our dog food bill is a whopping $2,000 a month.
A month? Wow.
Yes. That's more than most people's mortgage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely more than mine. And then, so that's a lot of meat in that chest freezer there. And snow machines, and you got some fat bites, and four-wheeler. Use a four-wheeler in the summer. Do you run them all year round?
We run them all year round. Well, we give them about a break in about June or so, the hottest month, typically, and let them get fat and happy.
Yeah.
You know, so they can rest up from the winter and gain a little bit of fat to concentrate on that muscle and just keep on rolling.
That's great. Hey, I'm here with Robert and the dog. What do you got here, Robert?
We have about 36 sled dogs here at Team Aneke Kennel in Willow, Alaska, getting ready to take Paul out on an epic 4 or 5 mile run. It should be a great time.
Yeah, and so explain what kind of dogs, where they're from, that kind of thing.
We have mostly Brenda Mackey line, so Mackey's racing sled dogs, all distance type dogs, no sprint dogs here. A lot of these dogs come from way back in distance history, even Iditarod history.
Great. All right. Well, let's go look around some more.
All right.
We're going to have six dogs. We're going to go about a 5 mile loop. So this is dog mushing. It's best. Noisy. You can load up. The dogs are super excited. And Robert's coming in front of me with a snow machine. Very wise. So they got these all
little-eyed sort of dogs, and they are excited. Taking the fan lines and the neck lines. Yeah. Here we go. And then we're mushing. Off we go. Aha. Took our first left. And it's quiet. It's a great thing about dog mushing. They're noisy, 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 and then they're just dead quiet. It's a beautiful day out. It's a little cloudy out, but pretty warm, about 20 degrees. They know where they're going. They've done this before. I said we're doing about a 5-mile loop here. What fun. This is great.
Well, thanks, Robert, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Really enjoy the opportunity to get out on a sled. It was a lot of fun. And meeting your daughter and your wife, and it's a lovely thing you guys here. It seems like your whole world is your center of your universe is dogs.
It is. And you know what? I have to say, I'm impressed, Paul. You jumped on that sled, and you had your snow legs, as they say. You did very well. I know it was just a short 5-mile run, but got to give you props. You look like a natural out there.
So did I passed? What kind of grade did I get?
I think you would get an A+ and maybe a nice little participation trophy as well.
Nice pat on the back. All right. Thanks a lot, Robert, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. I'm here with Nicole, right?
Forto,
and so you're Robert's daughter. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been mushing.
So I'm 24 now. I've done mushing and been in the dog world since basically I could walk. I did my first race at 3 when I was 15, 16, 17. I did Junior Iditarod and Willow 100. I've done tons of sprint races. So I've pretty much been dogs my whole life, actually. And I love mushing. I love the independence it gives. And kind of like the trusting that it gives you to build with your dogs and all of the lessons you get to learn.
That's great. And what else do you do besides dog mushing?
So dog mushing is more something I do recreational now. So I'm actually a dog trainer. I'm part business owner for our business Dog Works training company. I teach people how to have better relationships with their dogs. Before that, I was a treatment counselor for teens with alcohol and drug dependency. So I have a lot of communication, counseling, that kind of life coaching experience.
And I bet that comes in very useful with, because it's not dogs, it's about people and dogs, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely, most things involving dogs are more about the people than the dogs. Yeah, for sure. Because dogs are easy. They're easy to teach to, you know, go run on a line or do a sit stay. But it is. It's definitely the coaching of the people. Yeah.
And do you have any a particular story that you would share with the listeners, like a memorable moment while out with dogs?
Really any of them. Probably one of my favorites is my last Junior Iditarod when we were camped out for our 10-hour mandatory camp. The Northern Lights came out. It was negative 20 degrees. I'm camping in the cold, and I laid down in the straw with my team while they camped out. And honestly, that was probably one of the most best experiences I've ever had. It was really nice and life-changing and just beautiful.
Is that like a moment when you went, okay, this is for me?
Yeah, but I also went, I don't know if I want to do this camping part of dog mushing anymore because it's just so dang cold. So it really kind of turned my, well, I'm not going to compete, but I'm just going to do this to enjoy it and have fun. Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's a great great insight.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Nicole.
Yeah, of course. I'm glad. I hope you had so much fun.
I did. Yeah. That was a great little run. Thank you. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. Thanks to Robert and Nicole Forto for taking me out on a 5-mile dog sledding outing. I really enjoyed it. We'll take a short break now. This is Paul Tordock with Outdoor Explorer. We've been talking about dog mushing, and after the break, we'll come back with a little bit about Nordic skiing.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Paul Trotter, your host. On this segment of the show, we're going to switch from mushing to Nordic skiing. Starting in the mid-1990s, the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage published an advice column called Dear Mrs. Ufta. And today, I have Alice Knapp, who knows a bit about Miss Ufta, to tell us about a new book that the association has published and maybe some advice. Welcome to the show, Alice.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to tell you about Miss Ufta.
Yeah. So this was book was put to these columns. I take it with you and your husband, Gunnar. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about the history of this and what it was.
Okay. Well, this project came about as a result of my COVID project, which is to write a history of the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage, which is coming up on its 60th anniversary. And so the past 2 years, I've been researching the history of the Nordic Skiing Association and talking to a lot of the movers and shakers of the club and amongst working on that project, I kept reading old newsletters and I came across the Miss Ufta columns, which I remembered really well from the 1990s. And I contacted Joyce Weaver Johnson, who was the editor of the Nordic newsletter at that time, and asked her if there was any way possible I could get in contact with Miss Ufta, who's a trade secret. Nobody knew who Miss Ufta was except for Joyce, who is the editor. And so I talked to Joyce, or I sent her an email and I asked her, could you contact Miss Ufta and ask her if she would be okay if we reprinted her columns from that 5-year time period? Because they're just so delightful. They're fun, they're witty, they address all these common issues that skiers tend to bump into in a very fun, witty way. And I figure there's a whole generation of skiers that haven't had a chance to experience Miss Ufta as we had. And so with a lot of help from my husband, Gunnar, we collected those columns. We did get permission, by the way, from Miss Ufta, and we collected all the columns that appeared in the newsletters and formatted it into about 100-page book that my friend Kim Olmsted, who's a graphic designer, updated the illustrations and added a bunch of really Nordic kind of little illustrations throughout the book. And one of the most wonderful things was after collecting these articles and getting them all formatted into this book, we added a chapter at the end about current day Miss Ufta columns. So we have about 5 new up-to-date columns from Miss Ufta, and they are very humorous, and anybody that knows myself or Gunnar will get a good chuckle out of them. The responses are quite fun.
Yeah, I noticed one about fat biking.
Yeah, climate change, fat biking, aging racers. Miss Ufta answers it all in a very appropriate way, and it's just delightful. One thing I thought that would be good to mention is when the first column came out in 1994, it said at the title of the column, Miss Ufta will answer your questions. And then it asks all these questions, and then it says, Miss Ufta knows it all, or we'll find out. Although her innate Nordic reserve prohibits our identifying her by name, Ms. Ufta is a refined, elegant lady of indeterminate age who has been skiing Anchorage trails for more than a quarter century and can still run those downhills faster than almost anyone because she knows how. She exhibits brilliant technique, impeccable trail manners, and sensible knickers. And then it says to write your letters and put them in the red envelope at AMH, which was really fun because in the final chapter where we asked Ms. Ufta to update, tell us what she's doing, and we said that we put the envelope back at AMH and put these letters in for her to answer to keep that anonymity there. So anyway, it just was a ton of fun to do. It did sidetrack me from my project of the history book, but it's a good sidetrack. And Kim Olmsted did just a fantastic job kind of updating the Miss Ufta graphic. She looks like a Nordic skier on old time skis with one single pole as in the Nordic tradition, and added some appropriate Alaska type folk art to it, including a moose graphic and with moose prints and snowflakes and Norwegian hearts and things like that. So it just was really a fun project. It's a good little fundraiser for Nordic. We had 250 copies printed. So it's something that, you know, will help Nordic just do something fun, maybe have a polka party like in the old days. I don't know.
So can you classify the different, you know, different types of questions and columns that were
sure
in there?
She sort of tended to address etiquette issues, and I'll read a couple of the letters to her that give you a sense of where she's coming from and how she answers these. Etiquette issues. Right. For example, Dear Miss Ufta, when one encounters a possibly confused skier proceeding in the wrong direction on our groomed trails or accompanied by a dog, what is the most polite but effective way to inform the offender about trail etiquette in the ski club's toilsome efforts to maintain trail conditions? Signed, Miss Mannerly Skier. And her response, Dear Mannerly, Miss Ufta is pleased to hear that her readers are willing to share the responsibility of maintaining and protecting our nonpareil trail system. Anchorage has both groomed dedicated ski trails and groomed multi-use trails. The mostly one-way trails at APU, UAA, Hillside, Kincaid, and Russian Jack Springs Trail are all closed to pedestrian and canine traffic and are marked as such. The narrow trails at Russian Jack are set for classical skiing. People may ski with their dogs on the multi-use trails, and it goes on. And then it goes, many of us buy trail pins to help pay for the costs of grooming. Try asking the offending skier sweetly, oh, have you bought your trail pin this year? When they look confused, make a double move. Explain about the etiquette of one-way trails closed to dog use and put in a quick plug for buying a pin. Yeah. So she makes things very fun in the way she answers questions. She also had questions about waxing and appropriate clothing. There's a fun one about certain body parts on men that tend to get cold and how to fix that problem. She has quite a few columns that where skiers, lonely-hearted skiers, are trying to find an appropriate mate on the trails. And one of the fun ones that we put on the back cover, just because it was a short tidbit of a letter with a funny response, was the one that goes as such. Dear Miss Ufta, what is the thing to do if I get stuck with my date at Kincaid when the gates are locked for the night? signed Casanova. And she responds, "Dear Casa, this is another reason for carrying survival gear in your car. Your decision will no doubt be affected by the quality of your date, the ambient air temperature, and how much farther you want to ski. As some poor Anchorageites can attest, Kincaid is not always the safest place to be after hours. If your car is locked in, you can call a friend to meet you and your date outside Kincaid." And goes on, "This plan would entail abandoning your car and reclaiming it in the following day. You can call the police. They'll be glad to unlock the gates and free you, but may give you a ticket for breaking park rules and missing the park curfew." But then she finishes it with a really funny thing. "You can bivouac at Kincaid, but this isn't really legal and it might be your last date. Wouldn't it be easier to ski with a watch?" And nice. And so she often puts little twists at the end that just kind of make you smile. And another letter that I just thought was really fun is, "Dear Miss Ufta," and it's appropriate for this year, "ski season sadly is nearing its end and I'm beginning to suffer from PTSSD or post-traumatic ski season disorder. How can an addict like myself keep skiing through the change of seasons? Sincerely, Will Winter." Dear Will, well, you can always try higher elevations, but I suppose you already thought of that. I'll let you in on Miss Ufta's secret pastime in August when she can't bear to go another day without skiing. I get out my skis and tie old towels to the bases and then tape them from above using duct tape. I fish out a couple of wine bottle corks from my silverware drawer and I apply them to the tips of my poles. Then I roll up the carpet runner in my longest hallway and stride away. With a cool breeze blowing through an open window, I can almost feel that I'm kicking and gliding along the Sisson Loop. And believe me, the shine it puts on a hardwood floor is incomparable. Yeah. Anyway, so she has a very witty way of answering the letters. And my people that I know that have purchased the Miss Ufta book and read it, they kept saying, "Oh, I know it's you, Alice. I know it's you." But it isn't. It honestly isn't. And I can honestly say that although I do know the identity of Miss Ufta, it came as a big surprise to me. It wasn't anybody that I thought would be on my list of possible Miss Uftas. And so the secret lives on. It's part of the great, you know, mystery of it all.
Great, but, that's a great mystery. And these ran from the mid-90s until when?
They started in the 1994 ski season. They ran for 4 years. There was a hiatus of 1 year, and then they showed up again when the Nordic Ski Letter became the Alaska Nordic Skier. So the Nordic Ski Club had its own newsletter, and then Joyce and Barry Weaver Johnson kind of converted the newsletter into a statewide Nordic skier. Yeah, so it was a 5-year run of articles, and we didn't leave any of them out. We collected them all. Most of them are still very timely. So, you know, yes, they happened 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago, but they're not dated because the topics are Nordic topics that, you know, Miss Ufta is really Miss Manners. I mean, she's Miss Manners with skis on. And that's what, you know, we can all relate to that spend our time on the ski trails. So
well, it is fun. Yeah. I really enjoyed looking through it because, I mean, I thought it was applicable just not for skiers. I mean, most of it's skiing, but for even in the summer for trail running and biking and just there's so many more people on the trails now.
Right.
And different types of users. Now we have flat bike, we have ski jurors, there's just all kinds of people out there, which is great. But right. Etiquette and manners, I think, really keep the trails a fun place to be, a place that's welcome right. to everybody. So it's really important stuff.
Yeah, there are a couple letters where she kind of says, you know, we should just celebrate everybody's out there and you know, get along, folks.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we get sort of creepy about all the people, all those of us who've been around for 30 years, you know, all the people out there, but it's just fantastic to see folks. Right. And I really think there's a need for this. I mean, I think of all the stuff like people playing music on boom boxes. There's a letter, right? There's all kinds of new things out there, which and things have changed too. You know, I think about, you mentioned Russian Jack. Well, Russian Jack is more multi-use now. So there's, you know, there are some changes that have gone on in the trails too. So.
As is APU, right?
Right. Yeah. APU swapped out a couple of years ago. They sort of gave up trying to keep it single use. Well, yeah, that's great. And where can people find this at?
Well, it's available through the AnchorageNordicSki.com website. If you go into the Nordic Ski Club's website and look under the About Us tab, there's a merchandise sub-menu item, and just look under book and it's there. It's $10. They will send it to you. They'll charge you a couple dollars for postage. You know, I found this to be a really fun book to give to friends that that have cabins. It's a great outhouse book, I call it. It's, you know, it's kind of that Reader's Digest size, and you can, it's skip aroundable. I'm a retired school librarian, and I always told my students that, you know, nonfiction often is skip aroundable, and this is skip aroundable in that way. You don't have to go from beginning to end. You can just browse at your enjoyment, and that's part of what makes it really fun.
It is a lot of fun. Well, thanks for being with us. Alice, this has been Paul Torlap, your host with Outdoor Explorer. We've been talking with Alice Knapp, who her and her husband have come out with the help of the North Ski Association of Anchorage, book, The Wit and Wisdom of Miss Ufta. Thanks, Alice, for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Paul. It was a lot of fun.
All right, next up on Outdoor Explorer, we have Darcy Dugan, who is one of the volunteer organizers for the Ski for Kids here in Anchorage. Welcome to the show, Darcy.
Thanks, Paul.
So tell us a bit about Ski for Kids. What is it? Give us a spiel.
Yeah, so Ski for Kids is a winter festival at Kincaid Park that brings in several hundred kids from across the city for a variety of activities. There's a timed 3-kilometer ski course, an untimed 3-kilometer storyboard course that has props hanging in the trees, and then a number of stations around the Kincaid Stadium for kids to try out new activities and have fun. And it's organized by the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage and Healthy Futures and the Muni, and a lot of volunteers who are either former kids or kids at heart.
Yeah, and we were trying to decide how long it's been going on. It's been a while, though. It seems like I've known about for like at least 10 years. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure the date that it started, but I know it's been going on longer than we've had our kids.
Yeah. And it's at Kincaid, and this has been recorded on the this has been aired on 24th, so it's what date is it? I think it's coming weekend, right?
Yeah, it's going to be Saturday, February 26th, and it's from 12 to 3:30. The timed race is at 1:30, but people can come anytime in that window to enjoy the stations in the stadium.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about the stations and what are the fun activities you have going on besides the race?
Yeah, so there's an opportunity to try out sit skis. There'll be a number of fat bikes for kids to try out a fat bike. There's always an obstacle course on the hill at Kincaid. There'll be a mock biathlon area with laser rifles. The Orienteering Club of Anchorage has an orienteering course that people can try out. And this year, for the first time, kids will be able to check out how to use an avalanche beacon and play hide and seek.
Oh, fun. Well, I want to do all that stuff. I want to do the laser and biathlon. And wow, that sounds great fun. Yeah. And this has been recorded. So this is this year, but this is an annual event. Is it usually about the same time of year?
Yeah, it's usually at the end of February, but before the tour of Anchorage.
Great. And what, so when they show up, so what's the deal showing up? Do I have to register? Where's parking? It sounds like there might be a bunch of people there.
Yeah, you can register online ahead of time. You should definitely register if you want to be part of the timed course. Suggested donation is around $20, but the event is not going to turn anybody away that's not able to donate. And the proceeds go towards the ski grant program, which helps provide school equipment for gym classes or high school or middle school or elementary school ski teams. So if you are a high school coach or gym teacher out there, you should check out the Ski for Kids grant program because this might be able to help your school. And I should also mention, I think a big part of the Ski for Kids is trying to increase access to the sport. And there will be several Title I schools that will be busing kids out to Kincaid on the day of the event and providing lunch and just trying to get as many kids as we can that may get the chance to be out on skis a lot or maybe don't get the chance to be on skis very often to get out and test their skills and have some fun.
And are you looking for volunteers also, I suspect?
We could always use more volunteers. Yes, there is a volunteer button on the Ski for Kids page, which is on the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage website. And it does take a small army of volunteers to run this event, but you get to feel like a kid again. It's pretty fun to be in the stadium.
Yeah, and we'll have that link on the Outdoor Explorer website for the show. Let's review a little bit. So it's Saturday the 26th. Is that mm-hmm. right? I got that date right. Starting at 10 a.m. and 12 p.m. And it and you can pre-register on the Ski Association website.
Yes, and if you haven't pre-registered, you can also donate when you show up as well.
Okay, great. That's what I was going to ask. There's in-person registration also. Well, that sounds fantastic and a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us, Darcy. Any other? What are you looking forward to most in this event besides maybe having it over with?
I'm really looking forward to it. I love watching the kids get excited. You can just see the twinkle or gleam in their eye when they're trying something new. Or crossing the finish line of their first race. So I'll be in the finish area and I can't wait to see all those happy kids. And also there will probably be a lot of crashing in the stadium as people try new things. And that can be, a goofy experience as well.
Yeah, a lot of kid energy. One other question, any age range? What's the recommended age range?
I would say zero, if you are in a front pack of somebody who is a ski enthusiast, probably early teens. We actually have a number of teenagers that are volunteers that come out and help. So I think for the ski race, like the timed race, I believe it might be up to 12 or 13. But we don't want to turn anyone away that wants to come out and try out these sports. You could be an older brother or sister too, that, wants to try out that fat bike. So.
All right. Well, great. Thanks, Darcy. We're looking forward to talking about the Ski for Kids with Darcy Dugan. Thanks for joining us, Darcy.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for listening to my guests Robert and Nicole Forto, Alice Knapp, and Darcy Dugan. Find links to Team Anika, the wit and wisdom of Miss Ufta, and information on the Ski for Kids on the Outdoor Explorer website. Finally, a big thanks to our producer, Eric Bort. This is your host, Paul Tordak. And from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, mind your trail manners, and we'll see you on the trails. Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters.
You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.